KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scherr's on sabbatical. Muslims around the world today celebrate the end of the month of Ramadan. Weekday producer Amina Al-Sadi reflects on what Ramadan means to her. That's coming up later this hour, plus our radio retrospective. A new study from the Centers for Disease Control reports that obesity rates for low-income children showed a decline between 2008 and 2011. It's a big change. Since the mid-1970s, childhood obesity rates have doubled in this country. Why do poor kids have higher obesity rates than those from well-off classes? And what caused the turnaround in obesity rates? Simone French is a professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota, and she's director of the university's Obesity Prevention Center. She joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can we start first with the problem of childhood obesity? Why has it increased since the 1970s?
Well, obesity has increased across all age ranges in the U.S., and it really started increasing dramatically in 1980 and kept continuing on upward. And so that includes preschoolers, which is the focus of the CDC's recent study, 2 to 4-year-olds. Why? I think it's part of the environmental changes and cultural changes. We are living in a food environment that provides a lot of calories, and the portion sizes have been increasing. High-calorie food tends to be less expensive and marketed heavily, and we are more and more sedentary. We drive everywhere, and now we have small screens with us everywhere we go. So I think those larger environmental changes that have been happening in our culture and really worldwide have contributed to the obesity epidemic, and it's affected preschool children as well.
Now, you mentioned that we've seen obesity on the upswing since the 1970s across the board. How specifically does it impact both low-income people and different races?
Well, obesity is higher in prevalence in low-income people and in non-whites. It's in the preschool population. In this study, it's the obesity rates are highest in African-American and Hispanic children. So the difference, the overall prevalence of obesity, which is defined as children who have a BMI at the 95th percentile or higher for their age and sex. Overall, it's 12% in the U.S. and in American Hispanics children, it's 16%, and in blacks, it's 18%. So it's quite a bit higher. It's almost three times as high. And in particular, there are higher rates in Hispanic male children and African American females. And I don't think people have really been able to explain why that would be, but that's just describing the prevalence. And part of it is that's independent of income. And I think some of the main culprits that we could look at are the price of food. I mean, for higher income people, although overall people don't spend a lot of their income on food, but for higher income people, they can afford to really buy healthier foods. But for lower income people, they might have fewer choices about what they can buy and where they can shop. So that's kind of one obvious factor. And another sort of pervasive influence could be the federal food programs. And those the federal food programs include WIC, which mm-hmm. is for low-income mothers who have infants or who are pregnant or breastfeeding, and then the SNAP program, which is Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Those programs affect millions of low-income families across the U.S., and so the way that those are structured and what they support buying as far as food purchases in the households could really have an impact, too. And I know with the CDC report, people have been, speculating about why are we seeing these decreases, what could be fostering this, and WIC, changes in the WIC program have been brought up by people as maybe one possible influence that WIC food benefits have been restructured recently and support healthier foods.
We're talking with Professor Simone French from the University of Minnesota. She directs the university's Obesity Prevention Center. Clearly, from the work you do, you're concerned about obesity, as you mentioned, in all sectors of the population. But why, for physicians and health professionals, is it a specific concern when we're talking about kids?
Well, because eating patterns are established in childhood, including maybe before the children are born, based on what their mom is eating and drinking and her BMI. And then when children, I mean, I won't go into it, but there's a thing called epigenetics. So when children are becoming overweight when they're very young, they could be sort of getting programmed to be more susceptible to weight gain. And so we know that children who are overweight or obese as infants and as preschool children are much more likely to become overweight or obese adults. In fact, their overweight or obese preschoolers are 5 times as likely to become overweight as adults. So we know that they're at higher risk. And since we don't really have any effective treatments for obesity in adults, we want to be able to prevent preschool children from becoming overweight in the first place.
When you talked about the CDC study and the possible connection between the federal food programs and the weight loss, they weren't clear really what contributed to this decline that they saw, which we should say wasn't like 10% drop. It's not a huge difference in weight, is it?
No, I think they were clear in the report, too, that they aren't sure why these trends are being observed. I mean, they looked at declines over from 2008 to 2011, and the changes were small. For example, in Washington State in 2008, the obesity prevalence in these preschool children was 14.4%. In 2011, it was 14%, so it declined by 0.4%, which is certainly good that it's in the right direction, but it's not gigantic. It's not, and we wouldn't expect to be able to show gigantic changes over 3 years. So it's a small change, but it's in the right direction. At least it wasn't an increase. But again, you know, 18 states from their report showed these small decreases. And then 20 states didn't show any changes, and 3 increased. So it's a suggestion in the right direction, and we want to be excited and encouraged by it. But at the same time, it's a small change, and it's not happening in every state. And we know that there's a lot more that we need to be doing to reverse the obesity epidemic, especially in preschool children. And we aren't quite sure. I mean, I think the next step is to try to dig in a little bit more in states and local areas to try to link changes that might have been occurring in programs that affect preschoolers and their families and changes in their weight and nutrition. I think we need to look at more of that because there is state-to-state variability.
There are some critics who say that really obesity is in your genes, that programs can make, if any, impact just a temporary one.
Well, I think that, of course, obesity has a genetic component, but the changes that we've been seeing over the past 3 decades can't possibly be genetic because they're affecting such a broad range of the population. Really, everyone's been affected by it. So there are clearly environmental changes that have been happening that have caused the obesity epidemic that we're observing. Certainly, genetic factors might make certain people more susceptible to the effects of these environmental changes. So some people obviously are more affected than others. And so why one person might only gain a certain amount of weight from being exposed to supersized portions and cheap fast food, another person might be highly susceptible based on their genetic profile. So I think genes have contributed to some of the variation we're seeing in response to these environmental influences, but But those environmental changes are really what's driving the obesity epidemic.
Simone French directs the Obesity Prevention Center at the University of Minnesota, where she's a professor in the School of Public Health. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We're joined now by Amy Ellings, who manages the Healthy Eating Active Living Program for the Washington State Department of Health. And Amy Ellings, I know that you've been online, so you heard Simone French talk about the 0.4% decline in obesity rates among low-income children in Washington. How significant is that number?
Hi, Marcy. Thanks for having me on your show. Well, we usually don't put a lot of merit in a one-time dip like that. We like to see a trend over time. The good thing is that we have been tracking this at a state level with our WIC data, and we've actually seen a dip over the past 2 years, between 2010 and 2012. And actually, using the Washington data, the largest dip in rates was from 2011 and 2012. And that wasn't tracked in the vital signs report. So we have 2 years of falling rates, which is exciting.
How does that compare to adult obesity rates in Washington?
Well, adult obesity rates have been trending up for several years. However, in the past 3 to 4 years, it looks like we may be leveling off in our adult obesity rates, which is also really good news.
One question I had, the CDC gave us statewide figures. Do you, in your calculations, break it down by county or municipality?
We have not done that with this particular data set. We do do that for the adult obesity as well as the obesity measures tracked for high schoolers, but not for this data set.
What do you think has contributed to the decline?
Well, I think, like Professor French was saying, definitely the WIC package change, I think, has had quite an effect. There's been increased fruits and vegetables, whole grains, incentives for more breastfeeding that have happened since October of 2009. So you have to look at the timing of that and say, well, you know, it makes sense that that would have made a difference. A second factor could be that breastfeeding rates among women on WIC have gone up from 77% initiating breastfeeding in 2000 to 88% initiating in 2012. And that's really quite a significant difference in about a 12-year time span. There's still work that needs to be done. We would still like to see more women breastfeeding at 6 months of age as well.
Yeah.
But I think that those two things have been really important in the decline. We've also been doing a lot of work on the policy and environmental realm that Professor French was referring to. We've seen some changes in child care and early learning environments, which would definitely affect this age group. I do think that the national focus on changing our environments to make it easier for kids to eat healthy and be active has made quite a difference, sort of changing the perspective from it being a personal problem to it being a public issue that we all need to be paying attention to.
Amy, can I just interrupt you a second?
Yeah.
Because I want to go back to this idea of breastfeeding rates, because we've heard a lot about the connection between breastfeeding and immunities that a mother can transmit to a baby. But how does that affect a child's weight when they're beyond babyhood?
Well, actually, breastfeeding is protective from overweight and obesity. Breastfeeding for 9 months can reduce a baby's risk of becoming overweight by 30%, over 30%. So it really is one of those protective factors that we're trying to promote here at Department of Health.
Do you know how it does that?
You know, I don't really know exactly the mechanism by which that happens. It could have something to do with the makeup of formula and how much sugar is in it and sugar preferences in children, but I'm not really positive about that.
So in changes in the WIC program and what people are eating, it seems what I hear a focus on, at least from the Seattle King County Department of Public Health, is some way to make fresh foods, fruits and vegetables in particular, more cost accessible, i.e. cheaper, for people who are on low income. How can that happen, and how much will that contribute to declines in obesity rates?
Well, as far as the changes in the WIC packages, women now receive a certain coupon. I believe it's for $10 for fruits and vegetables, or perhaps $8. And children also receive a coupon for fresh fruits and vegetables, a WIC coupon. So that is definitely increasing their access to the fresh fruits and vegetables. We're also looking at ways to do this in corner stores and in neighborhood stores. You know, how can we make healthy, fresh, affordable foods accessible to people in all communities, particularly those that do not have access to healthy foods? And it's definitely, it's very difficult. We have distribution issues to look at. There are issues with refrigeration and with spoilage that happen in smaller stores. Getting people to purchase the healthier items is an issue. So it's an issue we're working on, definitely.
Amy Ellings manages the Healthy Eating Active Living Program for the Washington State Department of Health. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
Muslims have been celebrating Ramadan this past month. Ramadan will end soon, either today or tomorrow. I say either today or tomorrow because apparently there's no widespread agreement on this. We'll find out why in a moment here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Kitsap Propane, whose pre-fill purchasing program and on-demand delivery simplifies winter preparation. On the web at kitsappropane.com.
63 degrees in Seattle, heading towards a high today of 83 and expecting lots of sun. Overnight, it'll be partly cloudy, dropping to 58. And tomorrow, Friday, clouds in the morning, sun in the afternoon, and a high of 80. 1023, I'm Bernard Ouellette. Today's restaurant recommendation takes us downtown to Seattle's International District. Food writer Sarah Dickerman will be our guide in 10 minutes.
Ramadan is here.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. Thousands of Muslims are celebrating Ramadan this month. Logistically, that means fasting during the day and religious and family gatherings at night. Of course, the month holds a much greater meaning than that. KOW's very own Amina Al-Sadi joins me to share her reflections on this year's Ramadan as the month draws to a close. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
I mean, you were already here.
Yeah, I was already here.
Thanks for coming into the studio. So we know that Ramadan is ending today or tomorrow.
Yes.
Why don't you know which day it's ending?
This is a conflict that is as old as the religion, which is, well, actually probably not as old as the religion. The problem is you determine the month based on the moon cycle. There are different philosophies and people have different interpretations of what that means. So some people feel that when the new moon is born, that is when the new month starts. And some people believe that when you see the new moon, so once it's visible to the naked eye, that is when the new month starts. And back in the day, there probably wasn't that much of a problem because you just went out, you looked for the moon, and if you saw it, there you go, it started. There wasn't a lot of disagreement. But for Muslims in the Northwest in particular, or not the Northwest, but the West in particular, that have immigrated from other countries, it's a little harder because there are different interpretations also of where the moon is sighted in the world and whether you can consider that counting for you or not. So
right. So since your dad's from Iraq, if it's been spotted in Iraq, does your family get to say, hey, the new moon's here?
No, because we're not in Iraq.
Right.
So that, I always find it funny, people who live here in the Northwest and the moon is sighted in, you know, Libya, and they're like, well, then the new month has started. But we live in the Northwest, and we don't have the same night sky. So our family and our mosque in particular follows the interpretation that if the moon is sighted in your horizon, then the new month starts. But that means that sometimes in Washington State, we're celebrating Eid the day before, day after someone in Panama City.
So some people want to get on with the celebration at the end, and
yes,
some people are stick to the rules.
Well, it's funny. We actually got an email from the Imam organization. It's an organization for Shia Muslims of the in the Northwest that follow a certain school of thought. And the email was sent out last night, and it was like, we've been getting a lot of phone calls and questions about when the new month starts. We would like to ask everybody to settle down. And, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but they're like, calm down, people. We'll tell you when it's the new month.
Sounds like people are ready to have it over with a
yes,
little bit.
This year.
But we'll get to that. I'm speaking with Amna Al-Sadi, KUOW's very own weekday producer, about Ramadan and her insight into how this year's Ramadan has been. But before we get into why people might be really ready for it to be over this year, just for people who don't know much about Ramadan at all, can you give us the basic of what Ramadan's supposed to be commemorating?
Right. So Ramadan is a month that's set aside in the Islamic calendar where Muslims are asked to abstain from food, drink, and obscenities during, you know, high emotions like anger, violence, bad language, negative behavior from sunup to sundown. Of course, the hope is that you abstain from bad behavior all the time, but in particular when you're fasting, you should not, you know, swear or do other things. And it is a holy month. It's holy in particular because the Quran was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad during this month, revealed as a whole. It came down, you know, cover to cover.
Do you personally set goals for yourself at the beginning of Ramadan of what you'd like to learn or accomplish or anger you want to set aside?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Something like being more patient. That is definitely a challenge during Ramadan because it's the hardest time to be patient, but it's also the best time. You know, the hardest is the best time. Sometimes you kind of feel like a spiritual void when you're you get really distracted during the year and your focus is on other things, other stresses in life, and you can kind of get away from the spiritual or community aspect of your life. And I just want to realign myself.
Do you think it's worked this year?
You know, if you would have asked me 2 weeks ago, I would have said no. But now I feel like, yeah, it has. It has worked.
What changed 2 weeks ago to now?
Well, a couple things. 2 weeks ago, in the beginning of the month, it was just really difficult getting my schedule adjusted and making time for things other than sleep and getting dinner when the sun sets. Well, I started going to a few different mosques in the area after the first 2 weeks. I thought like it would be a good opportunity this year to explore, see what other people are doing in the local area. And I just had a really good time getting to know other communities, but also there were some really great speakers at other communities that provided a more intellectually stimulating, but also a more comforting atmosphere.
Maybe we should lay out what the days look like for you right now. You're here at work all day long, starting really early in the morning.
Yes.
And Jason and I and Marcy, we're all drinking tea and eating at our desks.
Yes.
And you're fasting all day long until the sun sets. And then once the sun sets, what happens?
Well, I wake up because as soon as I get home from work, I go to sleep for maybe 3 or 4 hours. I wake up every night. It's a little different because some nights we'll go to the mosque, or my family goes to the mosque a lot, and the programs usually are before iftar because there's maybe like 7 hours of sunset or 7 hours of night. The programs have all shifted to happen before iftar.
That's when you eat. That's the dinner, right?
Iftar is the dinner when we get to eat. We'll break our fast with whatever food is there, usually a soup, something small to kind of ease you into it. And then dinner varies just depending on what everyone's kind of craving that day. Mm-hmm. And then everyone will either, you know, go off to their rooms and kind of try to get stuff done that they couldn't do while they were fasting. I mean, by the time we're finished eating, it's like maybe 11 or 12. Once like you've cleaned up and you've settled and you're full of, you have energy again. And then you realize, oh, in 2 hours, I'm going to have breakfast and it's time to start again. So
you're basically sleeping in the afternoon after work and that's pretty much it?
Yes. I go to bed around 2 or 3 a.m., depending on when I can actually fall asleep. My alarm wakes me up at 5:30. I get into work. I work. And then
She's still doing a good job, by the way.
Thanks. Oh, who knows? as soon as I get home, if I can hit hit my pillow, I will. Although the last couple weeks, I've been joining my family at the mosque because otherwise I'm not going or doing anything. Otherwise, like, I'm just fasting. And it just feels like when you're just fasting, you're missing a lot of what the month actually is. Just fasting can be lonely and you get frustrated and you need that extra spiritual juice to make it worthwhile and keep you motivated.
How do you learn how to fast?
When I was kind of young, 7 or 8, I would do half fasts. So we would, I'd wake up, I wouldn't have breakfast, and then I just wouldn't eat or drink anything until noon or lunchtime, 1, 2. And if I felt like I could keep going through the day, I would. Back then, it was winter fasts, so the days were really short, and it was really easy to fast. It's definitely a psychological thing. You just sort of put your mind to it.
How do you stay healthy? Oh. I mean, it's been so hot this month, and you're not drinking any water or eating anything. How do you stay healthy?
I got a special cup that has a straw with it. And it's like 20 ounces, and so I measure it. And so the minute I break my fast, I have my cup of water, and I'm just drinking it as much as possible throughout the night. I try to get 64 ounces in, because that's the recommended daily number of ounces. I try to get like 8 cups of water, or more if I can. But, I mean, inevitably, once you're outside during the day, you're going to get dehydrated regardless, but I find it's just even a little easier if I'm drinking water. I've pretty much cut out anything that's really salty, because even just a little bit of salt at night really gets you like bloated and dehydrated the next day, even if you're drinking water. I found that all the traditional foods that we usually eat during Ramadan.
I'm speaking with Amina Alsadi, a weekday producer, about her personal experience with Ramadan this year. Now, you were sending me links of some of the products you've been purchasing to celebrate these next couple days.
Yes.
Tell me what you bought.
Well, I got a little excited one afternoon, and I went online and searched Eid products. This year, all of our Eid lights were, well, actually, they're Christmas lights, but we call them Eid lights. They were dead. So we needed new lights, but we realized, wow, they don't sell lights at Target in July. So I looked online and kind of fell down a rabbit hole of Eid products that I didn't realize existed. apparently, there's this huge market for decorations and accessories for your month. And so I just went, I didn't go too crazy. I really held back. I just got a string of lanterns, paper lanterns. It's like a garland. They're shades of green. And I think they have some glitter or something on them to string up. And then green lights and white lights. And we still have some old garlands and stuff. Usually what we do is around Christmas stock up on the after Christmas sales on different decorations that are sort of generic and just festive. And then we put them up. But this is the first year that we're going to have actually Ramadan and Eid specific decorations.
Mm-hmm. Now, is green and white the colors? Kind of like red and green is the Christmas colors?
Yeah, and I don't even know. I know there's probably a history to it. Some people say that, oh, the colors the prophet would wear were green or white. I don't have the historical. That's just traditions that are told.
Well, you were lamenting slightly, though, that with this rabbit hole you fell into, that Eid is becoming over-commercialized.
Definitely.
Which is exactly what we hear about Christmas every year and Hanukkah and all these other. So you're following suit, is what you're saying.
It's finally hit the Muslims. I think they've been here long enough. They've been in the West long enough. And in the East as well. I mean, it's super commercialized there. But I think because we were removed from the products there, we didn't feel it. So when I was a kid, you couldn't find Ramadan and Eid specific products. So what we would do is we'd make our own decorations. My mom would have us make paper chains or paper lanterns, things that are festive, you know, that just had a really nice homemade craft feel to it. But now we can buy it. So I'm a little sad that some of that is kind of gone.
But do you think you'd have time to make all that thing this year?
Nope. No. Last night I decided I wanted to make, like, do some baking, maybe bake a pie or something, and then I fell asleep at 11:30.
Mm-hmm. I should mention, before we're done, I think it's interesting what your brother's strategy has been to get through this year.
My brother's had what I would classify as the best Ramadan ever, compared to my Ramadan, which was
possibly the worst.
Maybe the worst. Yeah, probably one of the worst. Not in a really horrible way. But anyway, he has a lot of really good friends that kind of live close to us. Two of his friends invited this speaker from Michigan who has been studying in Iraq. And he's a really awesome speaker. His English is really good, which is actually a problem some Muslim kids have, finding speakers who can speak our language, not just the English language, but can speak to us in terms and philosophies that we understand and cultural references that we get. He's one of those speakers. He's really great. So my brother's been going over to his friend's house every night for dinner, and they'll stay up all night. They'll like go play basketball and do whatever they do all night. They have a bonfire in their backyard. He'll just be there from like 8 until, you know, 2 or 3 a.m. That's when he'll walk in the door as we're going, getting ready to go to bed. And then he'll get to sleep for a lot of the day. It's really hard to sleep for 14 hours, but even 8 hours of sleep through the fast is 8 hours of less fasting, yeah. Even though you'll probably still have 8 hours left of fasting.
So is that cheating?
Well, yes and no.
I mean, his older sister, does it feel like cheating?
It does, because I have to fast through all of it. But, no. I mean, there's no way around having to fast for a long period of time this Ramadan, because there's so much daylight. You know, they're only sleeping for 7 or 8 hours, and they still have another 7 or 8 left, whereas maybe I'm fasting for 10, 12 hours. So, I mean, it's not a huge... I get, like, now and again, I'll get the afternoon nap in, so.
It's still hard.
It's still really hard.
You've done a good job.
Oh, thanks. Mm-hmm.
What would you say that you've learned about yourself this year from Ramadan?
I've learned that, first of all, this is so cliche, but anything that you put your mind to, you can do. At the beginning of the month, I thought, for sure, I'm not going to survive. Like, working and fasting for this long, I'll have no sleep, and without any sleep, I will not be able to function, and I'm just going to totally collapse. That's what I thought going in, and then I found, actually, you can survive. I mean, it's completely mind over matter. Like, there was one day where it was overcast, and it was, like, the quickest day ever, and I realized that's because your brain psychologically thinks, because it's dark, the night's coming soon, even though the hours were the same. I think the hardest thing has been the bright sunshine, just reminding us that it's always daylight here in the Northwest. And pretty much. So on one hand, that's a positive thing. Another thing I found is that I have a really short fuse. I'm really impatient. And it's like when you're fasting, all of a sudden you just have no sympathy for things that you usually just let slide. People walking in the street slowly in front of you when you have some place to go. You're just like, guys, I'm fasting. You need to move. Like, I need to get somewhere. And then also, fasting can make you pretty spacey.
I'm jealous of the experience that you're going to be having in the next couple of days as you celebrate the end of Ramadan with your family.
Yes, I'm very excited this year. I think this year we have a lot more decorations. I got all my Eid shopping done last weekend. I'm so ready. Looking forward to the parties.
Thanks, Amina.
You're welcome.
This is Weekday.
Amina Al-Sadi reflecting on the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Amina spoke with KUOW's Katie Sewell. It's 10:40, an appreciation of old-time radio, in a minute, on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Gina lost her little girl.
Your daughter, Katie, is dead.
Or did she?
I saw her.
Is it really her daughter?
Fred Melamed is a successful voiceover artist and an actor. He plays a successful voiceover artist in the new film, In a World. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Melamed and the film's writer, director, and star, Lake Bell. Join us.
That's tonight at 8 o'clock on KUOW2, KUOW's second program service. Check it out at KUOW2.org.
Support for KUOW comes from Youth Care, providing education and employment training, shelter, and housing programs to help get homeless youth off the streets and preparing for life. More information at www.youthcare.org.
Be afraid. Be very afraid. No, really, it might help you. Today in the noon hour, we'll hear from a doctor who helps people overcome their fears through exposure therapy. So what are you afraid of? Heights? Public speaking? Clowns? Give us a call now and share your fear. 206-221-3663. 206-221-3663. Share your fear and hear tips on how to overcome your fears today during the noon hour on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. 64 degrees and mostly sunny, expecting to reach 83 this afternoon. It's 10:42.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking.
Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, cast your ears back to the golden age of radio. And, as is unfortunately typical and to be expected, there weren't a lot of female directors during the golden age of radio. And Katie Sewell thought we should spend the radio retrospective segment today highlighting the career of one of the most respected female directors of the golden age. Great.
That's right. Her name was Nyla Mack, and she ultimately became known for this show.
Pretend. Well, hello, pretenders.
And she ultimately became known for this show.
Let's pretend. Well, hello, pretenders. Well, thank you for that great big welcome. Sybil, what's our story?
The all-time favorite of all the years, Uncle Bill. Cinderella.
And Arthur Anderson says how we travel.
Well, on a brisk morning like this, what could be sweeter than a brisk gallop through the park?
Well, fine, Arthur. Give every man a horse he can ride, and away we go. All right, girls and fellas, head straight for Let's Pretend. Turn left for the story of Cinderella. Let's go.
Katie, never heard of this show. Never have
how
heard it.
How can that be true?
This is the hard-boiled detectives.
This
was
the most successful radio show for kids during the golden age, Steve.
Is that right? So a lot of our listeners are going to say, are going to have had their minds blown. They've just taken back in time.
They just realize that you don't know anything about radio whatsoever.
About to.
It ran from 1930 to 1954.
Wow.
That is a really long run. And it was carried by more stations than most shows were, too.
Wow.
But doing a kid's show was never anything that Nyla Mack actually set out to do. She was an only child. Her father was a railroad engineer and her mother was a dance instructor. And she loved performing arts from a very young age. And her parents, doting on their only daughter, encouraged her. They trained her to sing and dance.
Great.
She acted in plays. They made sure she learned how to play the piano. And even in interviews, she'll admit that she was kind of spoiled by them. But she had several major tragedies.
They were just nurturing her inner arts and soul, and they did a good job.
Well, they did send her to finishing school. she had several major tragedies, however, in her young life. Her father was the only person killed in a terrible train derailment, though he was alive long enough for her mother and Nyla to have a chance to talk to him before he passed away. And it's quite, the derailment story is an amazing story. People should really look it up and read it. I was going to go into it, but then I thought I was getting too far off
track.
But
just Google Nyla Mack.
Nyla Mack, yeah. Maybe I'll put a link up where you can actually read her whole life story. Her husband, who was an actor named Roy Bryant, died quickly, leaving her a widow by the age of 35. And in 1929, CBS had hired her to be a radio actress, but she ended up having to quit to take care of her mother in Arkansas City. So she has all these things that kind of, you know, make her stumble. But this is where things start turning around. So she's in Arkansas City. She doesn't want to just sit around in her old hometown. So instead, she becomes the program director of the new Arkansas radio station that's starting up. And she learns everything from radio writing to selling advertising. And then when CBS comes calling in 1930, she knows she's ready because she's done all these different things. And they wanted to hire her to direct their very struggling kids show, The Adventures of Helen and Mary. Now, she was surprised. She said to them, really, you want a childless widow to save your kids' show? That was her response. I don't even like kids, is what she was telling friends of hers. But it was the Depression, and she didn't think that turning down a really good job was an option at that point. So she agreed. But she really didn't like adventure shows. She liked fairy tales, and so it didn't take her long to turn this struggling adventure show into Let's Pretend.
What is your name?
They call me Cinderella, Your Highness.
My lovely Cinderella, once more I ask you, will you be my bride and queen and rule my kingdom with me?
In spite of my rags, you ask me to be your queen?
In spite of everything, you're the most precious thing in life to me. Will you say you'll marry me?
Yes, my prince, I will.
In spite of her rags, Katie, in spite of your rags, Katie, I know why you love this show.
Oh, I'm glad you noticed that final speech. She wrote, now Nyla wrote these scripts, most of them.
Really?
And she directed the show, and she frequently was the one that composed the music as well. She operated on the theory.
She composed the music too?
Yeah, she's a piano player, an accomplished piano player. She can do everything, Steve. She operates on the theory that fairy tales are a child's guide to the eternal truths of life. That was her theory. And
well,
as you heard in that final speech...
As many a scholar will agree with her on that.
Yes. And as you hear in that final speech that the prince made, she wrote the scripts so that they delivered a clear moral lesson, even if it meant changing the story's ending. For example, take Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. First of all, she renamed Snow White Snowdrop for some reason. I'm not sure why. And she wasn't about to have the story end with
Snow... She's going to get sued by Disney or in the future.
Well, yeah. Disney, that movie hadn't come out yet.
I know.
And she wasn't about to end her story with Snowdrop just abandoning her dwarves in the woods while she moved into a castle.
Come, dwarfs. Our procession has changed from one of sorrow to great happiness. Come.
Where, Your Highness?
To the palace, where all of you will be made welcome. And have a home always.
Oh, how nice. Thank you, dear prince. I couldn't live without my little friends. You will come, won't you?
Can we see Snowdrop every day?
Yes, Yaha.
And have pudding every day?
As often as you want it.
She also used her scripts to speak out about racial prejudice. She even wrote an original drama called Castles of Hatred to combat the fairy tale idea that all stepmothers are cruel.
Oh, she sounds great.
She's great. Her cast was also unique in the world of radio theater. Let's listen to the credits from the earlier Cinderella episode.
The pretenders for today were Cinderella.
Marilyn Erskine.
The Prince.
Albert Alley.
The Stepmother.
Miriam Wolfe.
Isabella.
Gwen Davies.
Flora.
Daisy Alden.
The Fairy Godmother.
Sybil Trent.
The Page Boy.
Jack Grimes.
The Driver of the Coat.
Arthur Anderson.
These stories are dramatized and directed by Nyla Mack.
Now, no matter how sophisticated those people may sound, they are all kids.
Those are all kids?
All of them. Wow. Nyla believed that to bring fantasy and magic in a sense of unreality to the radio, child actors were the only way to do it.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And she hired kids ages 6 to 16. So those people you heard are all in that age bracket. And she trained them very slowly. She allowed them to become excellent radio actors over time, just starting them with little tiny bit parts, moving them up, so that they're taking over as the others are getting older. Eventually, she ends up with a company of 40-plus child actors that she can call on. So let's listen to another scene, keeping in mind now that these are all kids.
Your father was one of the many victims of Bulabus.
Bulabus? The giant who lives in the Granite Mountain?
Yes. He killed your father, destroyed our home, and took every piece of gold we had.
A monster.
Yes, Jack, but that's past and done. The point is, what are we going to do now?
Let's listen to one more example. This is from Beauty and the Beast.
Yes, here is a perfect rose. I'll pick it.
How dare you pick my roses?
What a hideous beast! Awful.
Wasn't it enough that I gave you the freedom of my castle, fed you and sheltered you?
Who are you? What is this ghostly place?
I'll show you by eating you alive.
Oh, no, please don't kill me.
Those are all kids.
All kids.
That's remarkable.
It's
That's great.
So impressive once you know that. I didn't know that. I've heard Let's Pretend for years. I had no idea they were all kids.
That's wonderful.
The kids credited Nyla with their acting talent later on in their lives. Arthur Anderson was a person who was in her acting company for his whole childhood. And he put it this way. He said, I sincerely believe that Nyla made actors out of many of us who would have otherwise been doomed to quick fade-outs.
Hmm.
Once their cute voices were gone.
Yeah, that's it.
Their career could have been over.
That's wonderful.
The CBS network also recognized that Nyla Mack was incredibly talented. They promoted her to director of children's programming. She worked on the 14th floor of CBS, the CBS's building in New York City, right down the hall from Edward R. Murrow.
Really? Mm-hmm. So Edward R. Murrow and Nyla Mack were
And Norman Corwin was also there.
And Norman Corwin.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
It's not bad for a woman who started out disliking children.
That's a great story. All right. I will find out more about Let's Pretend. You'll put some links up so people can find out more, too.
I will.
Katie Sewell produces Radio Retrospective. I just come in lately and just get a chance to talk with her. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you, too.
This is Weekday.
Well, it's Thursday, and we welcome back food writer Sarah Dickerman. She's in the studio again, which is such a treat. And Sarah, last week we talked picnics, but this week we're going back to the tried and true Asian. You have a suggestion that's a place I know and love in Seattle's International District.
Mm-hmm. It's been around forever, and somehow I hadn't managed to make it there until this year, so it was a real delight. It's called Phnom Penh Noodle House, and it's right in the International District, and it's just there's so many wonderful Southeast Asian flavors as well as Chinese flavors that sort of all merge together in that cuisine.
So are Cambodian, I'm assuming it's Cambodian because it's
yes.
Phnom Penh,
mm-hmm.
are Cambodian noodles related to pho? Everybody knows pho now, the mm-hmm. Vietnamese kind of soup. Is it like that?
It's a little bit different. Of course, there's tendrils that it shares with it. But for example, I had a really nice duck noodle soup with delicious, lots of crispy fried garlic bits on top.
Mm.
And I just thought that was spectacular, really. And a little bit of that star anise flavor that you get with the duck. And it was just a lovely soup. So that's really a little bit different from some of the pho's I've seen. And then you can get different kinds of noodles. You can get big fat dry noodles that are sort of stir fried Chinese style mi ka tang. And there's, you know, sort of slurpy, sort of slightly sweet stir fry. You can get the thin rice noodles, also stir-fried, too.
Are some of the noodles wheat, made with wheat or buckwheat?
I think some have some wheat in them, yes.
I'm not so familiar. I have eaten at Phnom Penh Noodle House, but I'm not really familiar with what ingredients go into Cambodian food. Is it like Thai food? Is it like Vietnamese food?
Well, yes. You have this confluence of different influences. So you have, in a fish cake, you have that lemongrass flavor. Mm. And they're those wonderful sort of chewy fish cakes that you have as a great appetizer. But then you can also get the duck as a separate appetizer. And then that's got a really more earthy, wintry taste. So you can get this freshness, or a sour soup that has pineapple in it that's like really fresh and bright. And then you also get this warm and inviting earthiness that has a more wintry tone. And they go together in a lovely way. And then like for drinks, I love the young coconut juice that comes with little shreds of tender coconut inside it.
All right, I realize as I speak with you that it's a trip to the International District in Seattle is long overdue for me.
It is. You know, it's easy. I drive by. Personally, I drive through it often, and I forget to take time and just really enjoy what's there. And there's so much to discover.
So you can go to Phnom Penh Noodle House when you take a break from the activity that we're going to talk about next,
yes.
which has no, well, maybe some bearing to Asian food, but not really any relation. Right now, we're in full-blown harvest season.
Right.
You know, the fruits, the vegetables, everything, the market stalls are just loaded with berries and stone fruits and melons, you name it. And so you thought it would be great for us to talk about how we keep these fruits.
Right. I mean, I just get this incredible guilt because I see the market bursting like that, and I bring home a huge box of something. And if I don't have time, I throw, you know, I slice them up and throw them in the freezer. But if I really have time, I want to make jam. And so I just wanted to mention a really helpful new cookbook, not new, but newish cookbook called the Blue Chair Jam Cookbook.
I just have to ask what the blue chair is. We have no idea. Okay.
I mean, it's her brand.
Rachel
Saunders is a Bay Area based jam maker, and that's her brand. But I don't actually know the full story of the blue chair. But she's this young woman who's absolutely consumed with making the most delicious jams possible. And she's very precise in her directions. And sometimes I like a loosey-goosey kind of recipe that makes me feel like I can be creative. But actually with jam making, for me, since I'm not doing it all the time, I like that kind of precision.
I think the thing that scares me about the idea of making jam is dying of botulism. let's just throw it right out there that I'm going to do something wrong and kill everybody who eats my jar of jam. And so is the secret heat?
The secret is heat. First of all, you've got several secrets, because jam making, you have high acid and high sugar, which are both going to inhibit bacteria. But in order to assure that you have, you know, the most sterile environment possible, she recommends heating the jars in the oven beforehand and leaving them in a 250 degree oven while you're making your jam. Mm-hmm. And so you've got a hot, clean jar to go into. So that's how she does it. And that's very reassuring. If you really are just so nervous, you can always just throw your jam in the refrigerator and eat it quickly.
I guess I could do that. Anything in particular in the markets right now can you make blueberry jam? That's what I'm seeing a lot of fresh.
Well, you certainly can do a blueberry jam. It's delicious. It needs a little acid to prick it up. Mm-hmm. And then peaches, those crazy, weird August strawberries that pop in. You get all this first wave of strawberries, and then suddenly in August, someone has this. It's usually just one person at the market has strawberries, and boy, those are always really voluptuous strawberries.
So when I talk about, say I wanted to make, I actually even have no idea of proportions. I mean, how much fruit, does she tell me how much fruit I need to buy to get a certain yield of jam?
Yes, she does. So it's all by weight, which is very helpful. So you can keep your proportions in mind. You do need to, at some point, if you're serious about jam making, you want to pick up an inexpensive digital scale so that you're doing your recipes not by cups, but by weight.
I'm supposed to bake that way, too, I think.
It's, you know, they're great. They're actually very, make it life very easy if the recipe writer has included those, because you can just keep one big bowl and you can dump everything into the big bowl, all your dry ingredients into the big bowl.
Oh, and then you're just adding.
And you zero your scale and then add what you need to add.
Well, that's a whole other conversation.
Yes, we'll have that another time.
Yeah, we will indeed. So it's called The Blue Chair Jam Cookbook by Rachel Saunders. And so you can make all your jam and then you're hot and sweaty and then you hop down to the International District to Phnom Penh Noodle House,
right.
Which is open for dinner, too.
Yes, it is. And it's a huge menu. I mean, it takes several visits to really get a sense of the variety.
We have our eating cut out for us, don't we?
We do. Enjoy.
I will. Sarah Dickerman writes about food for many publications, Bon Appetit, Slate, The New York Times, at her website, sarahdickerman.com. And you can follow her on Twitter at Sarah Dickerman. It's always great to have you in the studio.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Our show, produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, and Andy Hirst. Bernard Ouellette is the engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. Tomorrow, our panel of journalists, joined by you, I hope, talk about the week's news, a lot of big news from the election front, and also Jeff Bezos buying the Washington Post, and Ken Griffey Jr. gets put into the Mariners Hall of Fame this weekend. We want to talk about it all. That's tomorrow on Weekday.
It's 11 o'clock, KUOW. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.